The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host, I'm Jane Coffendaffer. Sorry I'm a couple minutes late, actually. Rob and Drake and I have been on here just chattering backstage. We found out something else we have in common to do with our children. And so we were just jabbering away. And I looked up, I said, oh my gosh, Robin, we're past time. So I just want to apologize to y'all for being a couple minutes late and thanking you all for joining us at 4 o'clock here today. Unusual time, I know. I really appreciate it. I know we're normally kind of a morning show, but glad you're here. I know I always say this, but I truly am excited about this show beyond normal, even because whenever I can cut it up with a fellow FBI agent, it's just so much fun. We could talk forever about so many different things, but today we're going to be talking forever about Nancy Guthrie. And I know, you know, that is primarily what we're focused on and what we're going to stay focused on. And I wanted to get Robin on because he has just a different way of coming in at things. I think different cases. I come from the criminal world. He comes from the CT world. There are two different worlds in the bureau. We call them houses. There's the foreign counterintelligence and kind of terrorism houses, and then there's the crim house. So I just can't wait to get him in my house, my criminal house here. So without further ado, and we're going to talk about his book, and I know my mod is all up to speed on his book, so you're going to see it throughout chat. Check it out. We are so excited to have Robin. I just had to put this comment up. I thought it was funny. Jennifer, where are you? I thought that was funny. NJZ, thank you again. The nicest compliment when you guys do a Break the Case membership. Thank you so much. Robin.
Awesome.
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, we always do our chatty Cathy stuff before we start. I'm sorry. We do the same thing when we're on Tony's show because, again, when you get going on the most important things in life, talking about our kids, you can go forever and feel like no time has passed at all. So anyway, it's great to be here. Great to be with your audience. I love seeing them in the chat. So thanks for having me on. And yeah, you're right. Two different houses. When I started doing the true crime stuff a number of years ago, I was actually pleasantly surprised and shocked about how translatable what I was doing for my 22 years into this world, which is just doing deep dives on human behavior and what inspires people to take the actions they're going to take. Healthy or unhealthy, it's all the same thing. Human beings are human beings. So that's why it's a lot of fun doing this.
Oh, that's great. Tell us a little bit about your house, meaning what you did in the bureau tell us and different places you were at.
Yeah. So thanks. I came in the bureau 97 and did 22 years, got out in 2018 when I retired, served all my time, all my first formative years, probably 10 plus years in New York City. I got assigned to work counterintelligence when I was in New York. My primary job there was recruiting Russian intelligence officers/spies at the United Nations, primarily in Russian military intelligence. And I got on our behavioral team there. And as if you listen to Jen, I'm sure she's talked about the BAUs and everything. The Bureau has lots of behavior entities into it, and I was on one of them as a collateral duty. Most Bureau entities for extra jobs like SWAT or anything are collateral duties to agents as their full-time job as investigators. And so I was a team member for the behavior team. I was undercover certified, and I did tons and tons of operations. My operations in my world were all about recruiting human sources, double agent operations, espionage investigations, hooky spooky spy stuff, and most importantly, recruiting spies. And in order to do that, especially with my behavior team, the number one thing we did every single day is strategize trust. We strategize what would inspire someone to take an action that we want them to take. And the most important thing, believe it or not, that we did was we strategized how not to do it with manipulation, subterfuge, or deception, because that blows trust. And so what I learned was that every single day, all I ever did was what makes people do what they're going to do or take the actions they're going to take. And so it all comes down to people are always acting in their own best interests in terms of their safety, their security, and their prosperity that they think from their point of view, which is deep active empathy. And when you understand that, translate into the world of true crime, what makes people do what they're going to do, they're always going to act in what they think is their best interest, which is safety, security, and prosperity. Now, when you can layer on top of that abnormal psych, abnormal behaviors, malformations of brain, chemical imbalances, unhealthy relationships, which is number one thing, which fuels a lot of the crazy out there and a lot of the nutters, as I call them, and wackadoodles, as Jen calls them. It's so much simpler because I worked in a world where you dealt with normal people doing regular things. This world is so much easier because, you know, these people that we generally cover in these cases were successful in life, they wouldn't be doing this. These are typically the greatest losers in the world. So I did that. I then went to Quantico. I taught this stuff for counterintelligence for a number of years. I went to the Norfolk division. I did counterintelligence there. I went to FBI headquarters. I was in charge of a big Russian program up there. And then I took over our behavioral team for a number of years back in, I think it was 2010, I got the team, or 11, somewhere in there. You lose track of time because I did multiple things at the same time. And I spent my last couple of years in the Bureau before I retired right here in my resident agency in Fredericksburg out of the Richmond division because my kids were in high school. And I was able to consolidate, come home, and not have to commute to DC every day. So that's kind of a snapshot of my Bureau career.
Love hearing all that detail, and you can just rattle it off so fast. So great. Two things. No, I love it. I think the audience loves it too. Whenever your people are giving their dissertations on their background, people want it bam, bam, bam. And that's exactly what you did. And it was so interesting, at least from my vantage, to listen to. I want to talk about what was your path to get in the Bureau real quick.
So I was a United States Naval Academy graduate, and I went Marine Corps after that. And I did 5 years. I was a captain. I was at Parris Island, South Carolina. It was my last duty station. I was a series commander down there, basically a company commander in charge of 16 drill instructors, 250 recruits. I did 5 cycles on the drill field, and then I was transitioned because you shift jobs down there. For any Marines, former Marines that are watching or listening in, if you heard a thing called about the Crucible in the Marine Corps, the final culminating event at boot camp, I was actually one of the writers of that with my team. And so we had an FBI recruiter came down to Parris Island when I was getting ready to consider staying in or getting out. And he said, I think Marine Corps officers make great FBI agents. I never considered it, never thought about it. And my wife was applying at the same time because she always wanted to do it. And so I applied, and I got in faster than she did, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. I remember, and Jen, you'd appreciate this, you know, it's a generation thing. And generation meaning that I had 2 questions. Because I had no idea what I wanted to do. I'm not one of these diehard, I wanted to be an FBI guy my entire life. My first question was, what's the retirement rate? In other words, I didn't know whether people liked the job or not. I said, how many people come in as agents and make it all the way to retirement? And back then, the recruiter said about 95% of the agents that come in go to retirement. I said, all right, they must like the job. All right, I can swing at that.
By the way, make sure you, mail.
It was mail? All right. I didn't know that. It makes sense though, right? And then my second question was, does all my military time count towards retirement? And so I had 9 years that actually counted towards my retirement. So when I retired with 22 in the Bureau, I had like 31 or 32 that counted. So I was like, oh, that sounds pretty good. Sign me up. And I had no idea what I was going to do. That's before they had career tracking. I came in diversified and I was very, very fortunate. I got assigned to New York City. It was not my number one choice. I grew up just north of New York. I was actually born in New York City, grew up north of there in the suburbs. Always swore up and down I'd never work in New York City, never drive in New York City. And the first thing I got assigned to do in the Bureau was that. And when I got down there, you're on a 6-month rotation, basically learning the ropes, learning the city. And I had my first firearms training. I was up at Camp Smith, it's called, that we did our firearms training in New York at one of the places. And on either side of me, I had these really senior veteran guys. And I was wearing a Marine Corps baseball hat. I was 28 or 29 years old. And they said to me, hey, what squad you on, young guy? And I said, don't have one yet. We're doing this rotation. I said, why don't you come to our squad? I go, cool. What do you guys do? And he goes, well, we work Russian spies. And I go, wow, what the hell's that? And so they're telling me about it, and it sounded really cool. And they're both veterans as well, because they said it's mostly veterans on a squad because it's a military target. So it makes a great, easy connection when you're trying to recruit people that have something in common with military background, military service, even though it's a foreign country. And I said, that sounds really cool. There's a vacancy on the squad, as I applied, and I really lucked out because those Jedi Masters were the cream of the crop. I was so fortunate when I came in, and Jen, I know you appreciate this too. It was a day in the Bureau when the senior guys, you had to keep up with them. They set the pace. They set the agenda. They were phenomenal. My Jedi Master, it's like if you were actually recruit a foreign spy once in your career, or at least part of that team that's part of it, it'll make your career because it's that rare that unusual, like hitting lotto, right? My Jedi Master that I learned everything from hit lotto like 14 times in 22 years. I mean, it's the most profound impact on national security out of any one individual I've ever met in my entire life. And so those are the master behavior guys that I learned from, because it all came down to how do you inspire someone to take an action that might not be in their best interest? And how do you do so with a smile on their face and put their life on the line and their family's lives on the line to protect national security of the United States? You're in a sales business. You're selling an idea that the United States is a great place to be. Go. So that's what I learned from them.
That is so cool. I like you, feel so blessed because my Jedi Master was the master. Organized crime under a Hoover guy. You know, I came in 90. He was at the end pretty much of his career. And when I say the end, he probably retired maybe 8 years later. I was on a squad at the time. Oh my gosh, he taught me so much. I'm going to share a quick story. So he grabs me in, you know, I come to the squad, which I was so happy to get on. I put in to get on that squad. Right. I was so lucky. I never had to do what you had to do. I never worked applicants. It was so funny.
Oh, I hated it.
Which I'm guessing is what that's what everybody did. I just got so lucky, honestly, and didn't have to. But anyway, he said, sit down, you know, the old guy. Dick Ludwig was his name. And he says,
what's his name? Dick Ludwig?
Yeah. Do you know him?
I know the name. Yeah.
Yeah. He's famous in the Bureau.
Yeah, that's why you know the name.
So many cases, organized crime, worked in New York. He was the man. He sits me down and he says, do you know your 281s, your 137s, your 270s? And,
haven't heard those numbers in a while.
Yeah. And I said, well, yes, sir. I think I do. He goes, here's the books. Here's your MAOP and MIOG. Don't you love me throwing out all these names? Here's your MAOP and MIOG. And see me in 2 weeks. And you better know this inside now. So literally for my first two weeks on his squad, I refreshed everything I could possibly learn about those statutes from that, right? Or the regs. So I come back in. And he literally drills me. What are you going to do if you have an informant in this situation? What are you going to do if you have this? And that's what we did. He literally would just ask me all these pragmatic questions. And then I would have to answer being able to support it from the books without touching the books. Hmm. literally what he did. And I thought it was so brilliant. And they don't do that anymore. At least I've never seen any supervisor do that.
Yeah, the mentorship programs that were unofficial were unbelievable. They, as I remember, the first time I put in an op order to do an operation, recruitment operation, you know, when I was finally allowed to do something after a couple of years in, right? Because they give you the low level stuff. They see how well you can be part of the team, and they kind of test you, nudge you a little bit, the senior guys do. And when I finally got a case worthy of something, you know, an intelligence officer that we were targeting for recruitment, I came up with, you know, I talked to my sources, I came up with an op plan, I came up with all these things. I remember sitting down in his office and he goes, all right, this op plan looks great. And he goes, all right, so what are you going to say? Like to the Russian spy. And he goes, and I said, I'm going to say something. And he goes, no, don't tell me what you're going to think, say. Say exactly what you're going to say right now to me. Go. And I was like, and he goes, no, say it. And so I came up with what I thought would be a good thing that I thought would be good to say. And he said, huh. He said, let me play that back for you. And he said, just sit there and listen. And he says the exact same thing back to me that I just said to him. And he goes, how does that make you feel? And I go, that sounds pretty damn creepy. And he goes, you're not ready then, are you? And he goes, so why should this guy want to be recruited by you? And I said, because of this. And he goes, no, you told me why you think he should be recruited. Why should he think should he be recruited by you from his point of view? It was the most profound question I was ever asked at that point in my life, because I wasn't considering it from his point of view, the other person's point of view. And that set the bedrock upon which I started doing everything in true crime. Everything we covered, Jen, is like, so why should the other person take this action from their point of view? Why does this person think it's in their best interest to do this way, this particular way? Because everyone puts a lot of time, thought, and energy into the things they generally do. Some people are impulsive, and that's what you always take into account. But they think it was a really great idea. We can start predicting behavior when you can understand why they think that was a great idea. And you start discovering these life arcs, as I call them, you know, the things that inspired them to be who they are today, the things that matter to them, the what's, the hows, the whys, the whos, all these things form the picture of who this person is. So you can actually start predicting what they want to do in life to move forward to what they think is success. So that's where my whole journey really started in the Bureau, was understanding. So why should he want to talk to you?
You know, this is a perfect segue because, of course, today we're not going to continue just talking about careers, although I've always think it's interesting to lay that. A lot of people don't know our careers or our backgrounds. They know we're former retired FBI. I hate it when they write ex-FBI.
Yeah, it's like saying ex-Marine. It's no longer just former veteran.
But you know what? I tell you, there are some people who are ex-FBI because they only did a year. They did too. And I always tell everybody, I'm not trying to say anything negative, but when you go and you look at somebody with a year as an FBI, they weren't FBI.
Right.
I mean, you got 6 months in the academy and 6 months you're getting out after that. So, or whatever it might be. So that's ex-FBI. To me, if you didn't retire, I get it. Ex-FBI.
Right.
That's neither here nor there. But to your point, I want to play this again because we're going to be talking about squarely on Nancy Guthrie.
Yep.
And taking a little bit of a walk down memory lane with this case. And I want to start out with this.
In a miracle, we still believe that she can come home. Hope against hope. As my sister says, we are blowing on the embers of hope.
The reason I wanted to play that, and I thought it went so well with what you were saying, is for a long time, I think people tried to analyze that from Savannah Guthrie's eyes and from the BAU's eyes, in a sense, from everybody's eyes. But this was written, what was said, I believe, in terms of how she addressed the ransom note writers. Was BAU getting in the head of what they would want to hear? Not what Savannah wanted to say, but what could possibly connect to what the people listening, how they could manipulate their behavior. And I wanted you to touch on that a little bit. I only have this particular snippet. I have them all, but I don't want to.
Sure.
But so there's five, just to remind everybody. There's the first one that was with all three family members, but the only two that spoke were Savannah and Annie. And they, you know, they had their notes written out. They didn't have anything memorized. Highly, highly emotional. The second one is Cameron. And Cameron basically just said, tell us where to pay the money.
Yep.
And show us that my mom is alive. And then, you know, the third one that we see, and then the fourth and fifth that are very emotional. You know, it's not over. You can be forgiven. Essentially, I'm just talking about the overarching thing.
Yep.
Talk to us about what you saw when you first saw all those ransom note messages. I mean,
I thought they were magnificent. Is the easiest way I can say it, because the first thing you saw was the emotional appeal. And so there's a few things you can, I don't want to say read into, but a few things you can assess when you see an emotional appeal is that one, you know the BAUs are involved with this thing. And so you know that they know more about who they think the profile is of this individual. And so when you see an emotional appeal, one, the way they're going to do this is they're going to let Savannah and the family write what they want to write and say what they want to say, and then they're going to come in and craft it and offer suggestions and thoughts to consider. That's what we always did with my behavior team. We didn't tell ever a case agent what to do. We always had a section called suggestions and points to consider. And when you could explain why you had a suggestion and point to consider for the audience in which you want to deliver the message, they 99% of the time would incorporate into who they were, so it could be organic and be true to who it is, just like I think Savannah did there. And so the fact that she's using an emotional appeal says to me that the BAU and the team involved in this says that this person will respond to an emotional appeal, because typically if you're dealing with someone high on psychopathy, it will roll right over the head and makes no sense whatsoever to them. It means nothing, because they're just looking for facts and data, ma'am. And that's why I think the second message that was put out was just in case that who the perpetrator of this is, either one individual or multiples, one person wants the facts and data of how to do X, Y, and Z, boom, 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 boom. But the Savannah appeals, I thought, were really majestic, because it kept appealing to an emotional side of whoever did this, as well as the willingness to give grace, the willingness of forgiveness, of the willingness to give anything, give any, just bring our mother home, you know, let us celebrate her. I mean, I thought the language used was very, very well done. I think it was very true to who Savannah was in the family, but also very finely tweaked and tuned. I don't think I'd like to give Savannah a lot of credit on this, because I think a lot of it was her, but I think it was nudged this way and this way and that, based on who they believed the audience member was that was being delivered to. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but I'm gonna put some hard questions to you.
Sure.
What do you think makes the BAU believe that these people are emotional like that? In other words, that this could possibly reach them, that they're just not your typical take the person, get the money, kill the person, and go on their merry way, selfish, hardcore criminals. What makes you think, well, first of all, I think we both agree the BAU thought that message, because it was in all the messages except for Cameron's.
Right.
What do you think they are seeing from Porch Guy and his actions that make them think that they could possibly touch him?
I think they're probably seeing more than we see, for one thing. Whether there's other ransom notes that came in that they think is definitely connected. I definitely think there's spear phishing and notes that came in that have nothing to do with actually who perpetrated this. But I think they saw information and leakage that they gave them some hints of of empathy in this. Maybe they saw something in the house and the way it was handled. Maybe the fact that, you know, they're looking at the time span inside the house was because they were actually trying to care for her if she had a medical emergency inside the house instead of just leaving her for dead. I mean, you don't know exactly what they know when they came up with that, but I'm deferring to the fact that since they did include a lot of empathy in those notes, that they see more than we're seeing. And Porch Guy, it's hard to see anything except he's got experience in doing stupid things in this. I mean, the first thing that really struck me was how well covered he was. I'll never get over that because, I mean, we've seen so many of these cases where someone tries to cover them. I'm just like a Koberger. You know, I mean, the guy was a slop show coming through. I mean, he looked so odd. He looked so awkward. At least from the description we heard from the survivors. But this guy had reps, at least a couple at the very minimum, of trying to cover up and conceal himself, as well as the fact that, you know, who knows how much Nano's blue.
Standing here today.
With the, oops, sorry.
I meant to put up something else.
Sure. You know, who knows how much Nano's blue with blowing the crime scene. But the fact that we don't have a lot more to go on right now says that the guy probably covered up pretty decently, maybe, because again, we don't know what the BAU knows. But I think I'm just deferring to, since their messaging was like that, they probably know more than we know, because we weren't given a whole lot that says this guy has empathy. Unless you're seeing, so what are you seeing?
Well, I want to put him up on the screen, and I apologize. I can't believe I didn't have Porch Guy more readily available.
That's all right. Everyone knows what he looks like.
Everybody says, Jen, you're clicking. So again, I'm sorry to click. But let me just, I want to get him up here because, sure. And I thought I had, I actually wanted to show the video, but let me at least get him up here. Oh, Porch Guy, where are you? I obviously have way too many videos of Porch Guy. And they're at the bottom. Sorry, everyone. Here we go. This is the one I wanted. Sorry, apologies. So the reason, though, a couple of things that I was reading into it, and I agree with you, though, that they have so much more than we have. All those things you named could also be why they believe this. But
and maybe they have much more. I think they might just have a little bit more leakage. That, and when you don't have much, you got to go on what you got. So that's why maybe. I'm in a big world of maybe on a lot of stuff.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Every dating app swap is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
But when, for me, a couple of the things that really stuck out, the number one thing was his lackadaisicalness
in 100%. Terms
of his entire approach to this thing. This wasn't like anything you would normally see where it's a blitzkrieg, get in there, rip off the thing, bust open the door, grab what you're going after. And
there's no behavior spike whatsoever.
Yeah, none.
Very
he
fluid.
Looks like he's picking daisies, and later we see him picking vines.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't think anybody's going to get him. He's absolutely, and so that made me, and I still say this, there's a familiarity beyond just the days that we know, and we know this from Savannah. I'm going to put this up on the stage. There is beyond these dates that, in other words, January 11th, the 31st, and then obviously right. Operation was on the 1st. But there, this isn't just about his site surveys to see what was going on at that time frame, those times of the nights. No, no, no. This seems like so familiar, so intimate with the setting that he's comfortable. Mm-hmm. We're comfortable whenever we're someplace we understand.
Mm-hmm. And he also wasn't. And the other thing I noted too is, like normally when you have someone come on your front deck and you have a ring cam or a nest cam of some sort, it goes off. He never was startled by anything or anyone the entire time either. There's never a pause in anything that happened on that deck. And on that porch. And that was also really striking to me. It's like nothing rattled him. Nothing made him. He was never uncomfortable once walking that entire thing.
No. And he expected it, right? I can't remember whether you and I talked about this, but when he was likely seen on the 11th, you know, without the backpack, without the gun, the other photo, it really, to me, I think that's such a big risk to take to possibly be caught on the 11th, or maybe that was the 31st. We don't know, but at a different time, that it's absolutely a secondary risk. In the crim world, when we're getting ready to do a takedown, and in your world, I would believe when you're getting ready to go to a particular area, we always hated doing the site surveys and hated going there because we're
didn't rehearse.
We don't want to, we have to rehearse, but I was always so fearful with each practice, with each site survey, that somebody would catch us and we'd get caught and we'd get made and something would change. And so it's a big risk, but to your point, and I believe you made this point before once, Robin, is yeah, but this made him better for the time of the op.
Yeah, no doubt. And the fact that he's so comfortable with not being caught, to me, said he's done this before, not just here. He's done it before somewhere else because he hasn't been caught before. In other words, he's not having alerting behavior because he's done this before, not been caught. So that's the other thing too. When you're then do your concentric circles about how many other homes or individuals are targeted. I mean, that's why you keep bringing in all this different analysis based on what you're observing from one individual. It just makes it really interesting. It makes it because his behavior really stands out from anyone else we've ever seen before. Not because it's so diabolical or complex or it looks professional. No, it's because he's so comfortable with what he's doing. I've never seen it to that level.
How about this too? And this is something that makes me think he hasn't done this before, but I want to bounce this off you.
Okay.
To me, it looks like he has double gloves. Yeah. And it looks like his glove size is way bigger than his hand. It's like when I get gloves that are, if I don't get small or extra small, those mediums, you know, I got crinkles and wrinkles and I can't grab things as well. And it made me think, and I don't think I've ever run this by you, but I truly believe the reason he grabs the vine, because remember, I'm an Occam's razor. I'm a pragmatist. I don't go with all this other stuff. I think it was because, and I bring this to your attention, I think he was having trouble gripping that slippery plastic camera because his gloves were overed and they were the wrong size. And as he's grabbing it, so he said, oh, crap. And he goes and he grabs those vines that would allow for grip. Hmm. And I base that in part on, look at the holder for the camera. I don't know if you can see it there, but there's actually the vines are embedded. They got stuck on the sides. So that's why I don't think he was waving it to cover himself, because you could just put your hand up. Look.
That makes sense. No, I'm with you on that one. I think that makes much more sense.
Yeah. I think he grabbed it and that's why you see them stuck.
So here's why I think that makes sense, because had he cased the house, which we know he did, you know, he knew that Ring Cam was there or the Nest Cam, and he saw it before, he saw it then. So, you know, because the other thing too is, if you know it's not working or you know you're going to take it down, why would you even bother covering up? So, you know, part of that thing there. But if your plan was to take it down, but you actually hadn't taken it down before with those specific gloves, in other words, he was able to do everything but rehearse actually removing it with those very same gloves. And when he's actually faced with the attempt of trying to do it and it fails, you got to improvise on the scene. And so why? And so he grabbed something he could grip it with. That kind of makes a lot more sense to me than he thought he's going to cover it up, because that makes no sense, because you're not covering anything up because it looks stupid. I don't think this is a bright person, but he's definitely not a stupid person. Well, I think he's kind of stupid, but I like your theory on it. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that, you know, we'll see if I end up being right or wrong down the road when hopefully this case comes more to light.
And especially if you say you can see, I'm looking, if you can definitely see branch debris on the side of that, that would make a lot of sense, wouldn't it?
Oh, you can. It's up in the, for the viewers.
That was on the upper left?
Yep. That's that branch debris. And I think he's, you know, forcefully like, trying to get a hold of it and rip it off. And some of that gets in there. He's not waving it. He actually, it gets stuck there because of the force he's using to snag it.
That makes so much more sense, Jen, because, you know, when you're looking at that for the first time, you're like, what does he really think he's going to cover with a branch? And he's already been caught on camera before. So it's not like you're going to cover it up and leave it, because he's already on it. See what I mean? So I totally think that makes a lot more sense.
And I think the other thing too is he's taking it, and I think he believes it will never be found. Like the information is gone.
Right.
I kind of don't doubt that somehow he knew she didn't have a subscription, because if she had a subscription, taking the camera wouldn't do anything. I mean, what would it really do other than delay the amount of time to go to Google, maybe by a couple of days to get it? So I just feel like there's this feeling of familiarity, of knowledge.
I agree. I've always thought that too. And my degree of knowledge that I think he had was probably first degree of separation. I don't think it was him particularly, because I think if he was actually the one as the individual inside that house, I think, again, I'm giving law enforcement a lot of grace on this, that they probably would have caught him already if he was actually first degree, like right in that house. I'm just kind of, you know me, I play stats and probabilities. I'm thinking it's a 1 degree separation. Like a lot of his knowledge of granular particulars like this came from someone else that did have access, maybe not him in particular, but then he did a lot of site, like external survey, like the 50,000 foot level, or maybe down to 10,000 foot level. But someone else was given the very granular, like they do have a subscription, don't have a subscription, and entry points and exit points, and actually trying locks and things like that. I think that probably came from some. And also layouts inside, internal to the house. Anything he couldn't get off of news media that was put out before probably came from someone else, I'm guessing.
Well, and Robin, you asked a question of me a while back, and I want to really answer it now. And that was, you had this great statistic. Give it to us again. What is the average or statistical, according to your analysis, time that an abductor spends abducting inside the house once they make it?
9 to 11 minutes.
Perfect. Because that matches up with my belief that 147 grabs this off, goes around the house. He's seen at 212. You know, we know that there is a camera that's Nancy's that caught a figure. Remember Nanos, we'll get to Nanos later, but Nanos specifically says in a spontaneous utterance, we have somebody on camera. I mean, but it could be an animal. Like too late.
Right.
And then they make entry, and then 16 minutes later, they're gone, right? 228, the disconnects, because in researching this, and by the way, everybody, yes, I am getting a pacemaker expert on. But in researching these pacemakers, they can go for quite a ways. I mean, when I say quite a ways, within a house. In other words, the Apple Watch to the pacemaker, It's 6 to 12 inches is the best signal, but some of them can go through a drywall, say. Can't go through brick.
Right. So
see how this timing works out with your statistics now? He wasn't in there 41 minutes. That's just the time with the snatch versus the disconnect. They're getting about that 212 time mark where he was seen outside the house. Or somebody.
Yeah, if that's the actual time, then that definitely fits more of the profile of a targeted abduction. But if you're in there for the 41, then that fits more of searching for something in the house that you either couldn't find or there's something going on in there that you didn't anticipate. That's the statistic on the time is, yep, it's right in that window.
See, and I love that because that really helped me do a deeper dive on right. What am I missing here? Because my philosophy, belief in what happened here is all adding up. But this time is not adding up.
Right.
Unless it would have been a sexual assault. And that's not adding up from everything we know because there was supposedly not much disruption. And this never struck me as something that was an elderly type fetish case. this was abduction from the
still. Beginning. And we're still, and that's why I'm still, I'm one of these guys, as you know, Jen, I'm the 50-50 guy, maybe guy, because there's still data points that aren't there definitively for either home invasion gone sideways with the panic escalation with her or targeted abduction of her. Because again, if there's ransom notes we don't know about that are better, I'm on that. Because in other words, the ransom notes that were provided that we know of don't add up to typical ransom notes. If the abduction time does fit, great, that works for targeted abduction. Again, really, really low probability for targeting someone this old for ransom. Again, a huge outlier in that. But again, given the laws of probability of nothing else really fitting, okay. But then we go down the road of the malicious intent or for vendettas or something like that. There's no data leakage whatsoever, which you would typically, again, I'm always going to go with the word typically because there's always outliers. If this was a targeted abduction for pain, emotional pain being inflicted in some way on either Savannah, Nancy, family member or something, there just isn't enough leakage from my vantage point saying that there's a malicious intent towards a family member to inflict emotional pain and suffering, because there would be more. There'd be a constant dribble. There'd be a constant poke and a prod. Again, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but all I'm saying is that's what I would anticipate seeing if we're going down the laws of probability. But this is a great case that it blows all those laws of all the probabilities for all these things right out the window. That's why we're left with trying to figure out what the hell's going on.
But Robin, riddle me this. And this is where I think it all comes together. It's a combination. It's not just, so for me, this is such a combination of in snagger, we know she's going to die. That's what I truly believe. I don't think they ever planned on keeping her alive, except maybe long enough to get money. Because for them, I really do feel like this is a hate. This is a vendetta to the family. They wanted to bleed everything. Money. They wanted to have emotional strain and stress by sending this to the, because I agree with you, not real ransom notes, not real for money, right? They couldn't keep her alive very long, a day or less. So then what do? They absolutely go after them emotionally and through the whole public stratosphere by sending them to the media. And when they don't get the play they wanted 12 hours later, they sent it to TMZ. So now they have the play out there. They're going to see that the family isn't going to pay because they know what the FBI is going to recommend without proof of life. And now they have caused, look at all the public backlash about it not being paid, right? And then, so we know the first two ransom notes are related to the abductors. But what do you think about this, Robin? What about if those outlier notes, which by the way, were sent by the same MO to the media, supposedly very well written, you know, the ones that keep saying, like when she goes back to work, that says she's, you know, I know where she is. I just, to this day, I'm not convinced that they're not related in some way. What are your thoughts on that?
And they might be. All these fall for me within the realm of maybe, not definitive, just because they could all be related. They could just be the first one or two could have been the real ones that they wanted to try, but they didn't anticipate her passing when they did the abduction. But then you had some people on the coattail saying, here's a great chance to kind of jump on and give some pokes and prods for some notoriety, criminal notoriety that people use as a motivation. My challenge with it being the primary motive is, in general, you see more definitive, more harsh poking and prodding. I would expect to see, I don't want to get crass, but body parts, something, you know, like dribbles here and there. I would expect to see a little bit more. I'm just saying more, because when someone is so obsessed with doing harm emotionally to someone, if they don't feel they're getting enough traction or enough attention, they get more obsessed and more obsessed. And generally there's manifestos. Generally there's a lot more precursors to these things as well, where we're going to see a lot more noise beforehand. And I just don't see enough noise on it. I mean, I'm not saying it's not, I'm just saying I'm ghosting down now what I would expect. I would expect more poking, prodding, and pain. More. That's a good point. More attempts of inflicting pain and suffering on the family than we're seeing. Not that they're not suffering, but people that have this kind of malicious intent tend to be more malicious.
I know what you're saying, and I see that, but how much more malicious can you get than Savannah goes back to work and you send a note, you know, trying to get some money and just putting them in the spotlight again because it goes to TMZ and it's all over the place. And then secondarily to that, there's something that's been really bothering me. And that is, was there ever any attempt at a proof of life? In other words, was anything ever sent in those notes? Nobody's mentioned it, but I keep wondering, was there anything, or, you know, in other words, was it presumed to be AI, or did they not even attempt it? Right. I agree with you that we don't know, you know, what's really happening, although TMZ does.
Yeah, and it's funny because I'm given the pushback on it, not because I think there's something else that it is. It's because I don't think there's anything else that's more probable necessarily, but everything is still so open to me because I would expect something different. But then if you go down the home invasion for something in the house and it goes sideways with panic escalation, you would expect to see something different there too. And that's why this thing is such a weird outlier, because the things you would typically expect to have happen hasn't happened. I'm hoping that it does get solved one day so we can actually get some real truth and data on this, so we can learn from this, because it's a crazy nutter one to me. So what I'd expect to see more, you know, kind of going back to the original question, I'd expect to see more taunting. I really would. I'm super shocked that they're only using TMZ. Why not go to NBC themselves? That would make more, well, to me, if I'm doing nutter stuff, I would do that. Because if they're so comfortable with not being traced with these one outlets, why not do more? Why not do more of it? If they had the body, if they had Nancy to begin with at any point, you want to talk about major taunting, major gruesome, horrendous stuff. There's a lot more horrendous stuff that they can do that we've seen people do in the past anyway, you know, especially if you're going for any sort of monetary return. Again, but you've made a great point on this. You never thought it was about the money. And I agree. I don't think it was about the money because they certainly did not make it easy in any way possible that we've ever seen before in any ransom case to get the money. I think it was an afterthought.
And I think the other thing too, Robin, when you look at NBC as an example, you know, a major network compared to a TMZ, I bet you anything, and I could be wrong, but I bet you anything before you got into true crime or whatever, I bet TMZ wasn't your go-to for news.
Right.
My guess would be your go-to would have been NBC, ABC, News Nation.
News Nation, yeah, absolutely. All of them, any of them, right? But, and it's still not TMZ.
Right. But my point is, if you look at TMZ's audience, first of all, they have the largest reach there is on social media by far. They're just, it's 4, 5, 10 times when you look at all the social media platforms. Then they have their television show too that does very, very well. And their audience is people who want to understand celebrities. That's their whole audience is celebrity stuff and true crime. They love true crime. I mean, they owned the Celeste Rivas D4VD case. They own that. It's no other network, no other anything owned that. They kind of owned Charlie Kirk because they had that. They paid that neighbor for that, you know, him walking around with his gun down his leg in the neighborhood, right? So I truly believe they went to TMZ very systematically. NBC, people who watch NBC probably don't even know barely anything about Nancy Guthrie. You know, and yeah, there's an 84, yeah, I think, or she's the talk show host mom, but not like what TMZ puts out there with lots and lots of detail. That's so, just a,
that it's a great point. So it definitely fits to me into the notoriety part of it. If you're going for criminal notoriety and getting your name out there to the audience that you want it to get to, but if you're doing it to taunt Nancy, it's not taunting Nancy as much as if you're going to go to her network and have her network constantly playing and constantly be in her face. Because anyway, I'm just like, why not more? It costs you nothing to do more because you just do more and it'll be picked up with more people. Again, not saying it's not, but I'm just curious. These are just curious questions I still have. It's like, why not more? And so I think you make a great point on TMZ and who their audience is. And it makes sense if you're going for the criminal notoriety. But I would think if you want to taunt and inflict pain and suffering on Savannah and her family, I would think they'd be doing more. If it was that alone.
Yeah. And I will say this too. I don't think NBC would ever come out with it. Just like those local stations, you know, in Tucson didn't come out. It was TMZ 12 hours later that came out.
So you could go out on TikTok, you go out on Twitter. There's a lot of things you could do and tag them on everything. And you know, they'd get millions upon millions of views if they did that as well.
Yeah. So, and I think if this would have gone to NBC, I don't think we ever would have known about it.
Maybe, yeah.
But to your point again, what about pictures? What about real emotional, you know, like we've seen in other cases? And I think you make a really good point with that. But by the same token, again, us thinking from their POV,
right?
100%. If I were them, I'm bad guy and I just did this crime, I would definitely be wanting to temper what I wanted to do with the fear of getting caught.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I have these avenues. In other words, for whatever reason, and I can't believe they don't put something in place that catches these notes. Does that make sense? I understand they're looking for the past. Why aren't they putting something in that can grab the notes? Do you know what I mean? After the first one came in, people put something on there. I just can't believe in this day and age.
Our lack of capability to do something with what we're getting is blowing my mind. I mean, especially, you know, I come from the world inside the FBI where we had huge assets, you know, technologically, that we could employ on big shit cases, as we call them, and not seeing any of that being effective or employed right now is blowing my mind. I mean, yeah, it just, whatever. I, you know, you don't know whether it's oversight, you don't know whether it's a lack of cooperation, you don't know it's because, you know, these morons that did this are so technologically savvy, which I highly doubt, that they know how to get around, you know, being tracked like this in some way. And even, you know, to your point that you've had before, is like, why not set a Bitcoin, half a Bitcoin, do something? I mean, you can do a whole number of things to test, to just get intelligence, to get more information, to lead you down a path that you don't have any answers to. Because even there's no, when you're trying to get intelligence on a case like this, or any case where you're trying to solve a crime or prevent, you know, national security disaster, whatever it is, there's no such thing as bad intelligence. Even no response gives you intelligence if you try something and it doesn't work out. So why not try something? Why not, you know, give some of the slush fund money that you have in case funds? Or besides, you know, Savannah's willing to do a lot, you know, to get information, to get my mom's body back. Why wouldn't this person even just send, if they're fine sending emails with ransom notes, why wouldn't they send a picture of the pajamas that she was wearing? Don't you have to show a picture of Nancy herself, just so that the family, there's a proof of life right there, that they were the ones inside the house with the only people that would know the types of pajamas she has is the son-in-law and the daughter that dropped her off at night. See what I mean? I mean, say, how hard is something like that? I don't know.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know, I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
But what if they did?
Maybe.
Something that Levin said, Harvey Levin, again, the head of TMZ, that really, really bothered me. And he said, he specifically says there's things in that note that only a kidnapper could know. And it was very general. I never understood whether he meant, and again, I might be just extrapolating too much how I heard it, but I always wondered, was there a picture? You know, was there anything? I don't know.
I would have thought there would have been, you know, Nanos has got such a loose lips, sink ships kind of mentality. I would have thought we've had some leakage if there was more in that note than what it is. And so, I mean, I ran my own experiments with AI, and I actually had it, you know, search, you know, social media for pictures of my own family and come up with ransom notes from what you could find, you know, with descriptors that only I would be able to respond to kind of stuff. And it does pretty amazing stuff. So until the non-criminal guy with no criminal experience of background, Harvey Levin, can give me some more solid examples of what that was, I don't really buy his description of how not AI that was. Because what are his reps in that area? I mean, it's not that I say he's a bad guy or anything. It's just you have no reps in criminal investigations or know what fraudulent crap looks like because you've never done it before. Maybe you have for what you do. That's great. But in this world, I don't know what your experience and reps are to be credible telling me that it wasn't X, Y, and Z. I want to see what that is ourselves and give it to law enforcement to make that assessment. If law enforcement says that, if the FBI BAU comes in and says that, I'll listen to that, but listen to Harvey? Nah, I'm not going to listen.
Well, you know what? I truly am convinced with those notes that they believe that they're tied to the first two.
Right.
Are tied. Because to me, as you talk about data points, we have three data points.
Mm-hmm.
We have, to me, the strongest data point is what Savannah said.
Yes.
Because I think that comes from her victim witness coordinator. And then you have that combined with the FBI's actions. Yep. Come on, Savannah, Annie, everybody, we're going to get with BAU. We're going to put out a message, not one, not two, not three, not four, but five. They did not do that for a practical exercise. They did that because they believe those notes are real. So that's why I'm convinced the first two, and I tell you those other two, I think there's such a misnomer on ransom notes. I think none of us believe that have worked in this business believe this was about money.
Right.
But is this part of the pain? And if it is, to your point, what more pain is coming?
Very possible. Yeah. I mean, so that would be more telling to me as well. Because if it is about the pain, there is more to come. I wholeheartedly agree, because why would it end? Because people that do this, that are that obsessed with inflicting that kind of emotional distress and trauma on someone, don't give up. There's no end state that satisfies them. There really isn't. When you are that fixated and obsessed with a human being that you're going to go to this kind of length and put your own safety and welfare in jeopardy to inflict this on another human being, nothing will satisfy you. Nothing. They will keep going until they're caught or they're dead.
Totally agree with you. I could not agree more with you on that. Okay, really quick on this Bitcoin you and I had talked about this with Tony.
And you were more the expert on it, so definitely. Yeah,
I tell you, we did quite a show. We had a Bitcoin expert on. I think people's eyeballs were going like this. It is really complicated. I think I kind of have what I would call a layman's grasp on it. But let me just give you the story. It can be traced. It's going to be like a Cali cartel goes through this, goes through this, goes through this. And it's excruciating to follow, but it can be followed if you're going to make it liquid. You know, if you're going to use it.
Right. If you're going to cash out.
If you're going to cash out, it's going to be followed. It can go to 50 other different accounts and things, and it's going to be tedious, but you can't hide it. And it's public, and they have these chains, and it's impossible to hide. However, he did point out, so if bad guy is watching, he did point out that there are currently two other cryptocurrencies that are virtually untraceable. So he said, if you took the Bitcoin, set up accounts in those two, you could hide it. So there's two that aren't traceable is what he said, but they would have to have that knowledge, set up accounts and blah, 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 blah. So to your point, you know, how sophisticated is this guy or these guys? Would they do that? So I just think there, and you and I both understand the amount of case funds that are in a case and the millions that are currently have been and will be spent on this case. It befuddles me how they don't tickle the wire.
I am 100% agree with you on this. I have no idea why they aren't either. Because let's go down the road exactly what you just said, that this is a sophisticated network that actually knows exactly what they're doing with Bitcoin. It gets deposited in one, and they do all these fancy transfers to mask their end state of who gets it. Great. That's intel now, because now what you can do is you can now profile how they did that and then overlay it all over all these other cases that you have other data points on. You have, because again, everything comes down to what have we seen before, what haven't we seen before, and what fits a profile, what doesn't fit a profile. So what you gain from doing this is intelligence, or they had no capability to do this, and that gives you more intelligence. You don't get any information by doing nothing. And so if you want intelligence, you have to take an action to get it. And to take no action and sit here and wait for everything to just magically appear, it's ludicrous.
And a Bitcoin right now is 74,000. So right now there's two Bitcoin accounts at play. There's the one related to the first letters, and then there's the Bitcoin account related to the other four plus letters now, the most recent. Those are all the same. I mean, those two different houses, right? This one is all the same, and then there's two over here that are the same. So my whole thing is he only wants half of one in the one account, the extortionist, the one saying, if you do this, I'll do this, right? And I know we don't want to, and I get this. We don't want to encourage other people to do it, and then they do it, and we have all these people encouraged to do this. But in a case like this, remember, nobody can see what really happens with the money or that the money is happening, except for Harvey Levin, the TMC staff. They're going to tell us. They told us when $300 went in. But $300 isn't enough carrot to do anything. I think, boy, if you put even a half a Bitcoin, 36, 37, at least somebody's going to think about doing something with it.
Get Elon on it. He's got extra money, right?
Elon could probably solve this in two shakes. I want to move on to your favorite guy.
Our favorite guy.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about him. And again, I think, but you and I are both not the type of person. Our platforms, we're not about putting down others or, you know,
never
quarterbacking per se. But I want to talk about what you perceive as mistakes made that may not be able to reverse.
So for him, he struck me very typical. I mean, from the very get-go, I didn't pay any attention to him necessarily because he was right in the stats, right in the averages for what we typically expect on big cases for mouthpieces to say. Everyone pounces. Everyone says how horrible he is. He's doing a horrendous job. I actually did the research on this. There hasn't been one case of major notoriety like this where people have said the sheriff did a great job. It just hasn't happened, right? There's always critics. There's always people saying what they're doing wrong, and that's expected. I looked at his department. I looked at the clearance rate of his detectives for homicides. They only had 12 in 2024. You and I have talked about this. They had a 100% clearance rate in that, so he had very good detectives. And I'm like, all right, so he's running a good department. He's just a mouthpiece. Everyone knows how to work around the mouthpiece. That's typical. Where it started to get unraveled to me was his. And typically people don't like the boss. I'm used to that. I mean, hell, most of my behavior team, we didn't spend our time working on how to recruit the spy. We spent our time on how to communicate with management to give us permission to work against a spy. I mean, it's really my team was working internally how to communicate with our boss's headquarters and other agencies so we could do the righteous work on the street. Literally, that's what you do all the time is you learn how to communicate with what you have to deal with, all the obstacles. A lot of time, executives are your obstacles. No problem. And so I saw him as very typical until you find out he removed the investigators that had all this success from those roles. And you're like, now you're an idiot because you're like, what do you, you know, when you start seeing people undermining themselves because of pettiness or some internal, I don't know what it is. Cause again, you're not in his head, but remember he thinks he's acting in his own best interests. Always remember that. You just have to figure out why he thinks that it is in his best interest, which can be very befuddling. But that's what he did. And when you remove your experience because of whatever issue you have with them, it's ego, vanity, they don't like you, you don't like them. In other words, the great underminer of everything in life is our ego and our vanity. And it looks as if, from outside looking in, that it has gotten in his way for who he had work in this case. And it's not, believe me, this is not taken away from who's working the case, how they're working the case. But when you don't have reps, years of experience from those Jedi Masters leading that way through, because they've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these things, you're going to be hamstringing yourself, and it just undermines the entire process. It has nothing to do with intent of these investigators, has nothing to do with anything except decades of experience, which wasn't put on the forefront, I think.
Yeah, I mean, just to wrap that in a nutshell, as we know, there are some leaders that if they are not in control completely of their people and they have yes men that they're surrounded by, they don't want to be. I don't think those are the good leaders, by the way. I think I had some of the best leaders in the bureau. I always loved my management for the most part. And it was because they welcomed me coming in and saying, geez, boss, I'm not sure we should really do it this way. Can we consider this? And I tell you, 9 times out of 10, if you're making a good point because they know you have the facts, they support you. But this is not that kind of guy, I'm afraid. I'm afraid this is the guy that you come in there and you say, boss, I really don't think we should clear that crime scene. And I really think we should probably send the DNA to the FBI lab because they have more advanced technology. He would say, oh, okay, no problem. The door shuts. Transfer so-and-so to the desk. Yep. I mean, yep. That's what we're seeming to understand. And that is the befuddling part, because especially to me, you know, I don't think the crime scene can ever be, that's just an unforgivable.
Yeah. He put himself ahead of the case and ahead of the victims. I mean, anytime you have someone that the balance is out of balance between self and others, and others in this case is the victims and the crime scene and the case, he put himself and his own vanity, his own insecurities, and his own trauma responses to all these things because he wanted to be surrounded by yes people. And if you didn't agree with him, you must be wrong, because he's got 40 years experience. I know the right way. It's my right is the only way. My lab's the best lab because I've been doing it this way a million years, and I'm going to honor my contract. I mean, all the ways he can rationalize his behavior as to it was the best choice, it gives you a really good insight into him, because he placed himself and his own thoughts and opinions ahead of what was best for the case and which was best for the Guthrie family, from outside appearances anyway.
And I wanted to put this comment up because I think it's a good one. Question, respectfully, how does calling the sheriff an idiot or criticizing him help solve this case right now? So we're doing a bit of what I would call an after action during it, right? We're just trying, at least this is what I'm doing, is a lot of people want to understand, how in the hell hasn't this case been solved? That's what a lot of people want to understand. When you have the person who did it on camera, you know it's a Walmart bag, you generally know likely where that holster came from, you have a gun you know that he had with him, you have all this clothing, you have DNA, you have surveillance, right? There's going to be surveillance at 2:30, 2:28, whatever hour you want to pick and beyond. It's going to be hard to do it in advance of the crime, but certainly after the crime, he has to exit at some point onto something that has some sort of camera. So they've got all of that to work with. Everybody is asking the question. I want to put this map up here. A lot of people are asking the question, so why are we where we're at? And my point is on this, is we are where we're at because we had poor leadership from the beginning. And that whole motto, the first 48 is so critical. And in my belief, the first 48 was squandered. And so it's really just to answer the question, why are we so behind the eight ball? And now we're even more behind because Quantico just got that DNA a couple of days ago. So now we're 2+80 days behind. Now we're 80 more days behind because they've still got to redo all the work the other labs did.
And this is a great question. How does calling the sheriff an idiot and criticizing help solve the case right now? So let's take a look at what I said and how I said it. It drew attention. And also part of that attention I drew to was I started about saying I gave him a lot of grace because he was just like everyone else. I gave a lot of compliments to his department and everything. And then he lost me. So hopefully by sharing that, hey, I was on this guy's side. I was giving him grace. I was giving the department grace. And then because of the behaviors he was doing to undermine the case, I want to draw attention to the fact that something different needs to happen if you want to have, again, what's the definition of crazy? Doing the same thing, expecting the same results. If something doesn't change, you're not going to get a different result on this case. So yes, I do apologize if it was a demeaning name-calling word of calling him an idiot. I typically don't do that. But I did want to draw attention to the fact that he lost me when he actually started out having me. And I know you said the same thing. You and I give a lot of grace to leadership in these situations because they're tough situations where I wholeheartedly point out no one is ever on their side. I was on Nancy Grace. I go on that show quite a bit when she wanted to talk about Nanos as well. So I actually researched all of Nancy Grace's coverage of every single major crime case that she's ever covered. She has never once been on the side of saying the sheriff did the right thing. And so I was like, all right, he falls in the averages of absolutely everything. But what did he do to undermine himself? He did dumb things by removing the experience from the case. And for what reason? As we're seeing, it was personal grudges, it looked like, or not yes men or whatever it was, but whatever it was, it was dumb because, to your point, he blew the crime scene.
Yeah. And I guess we're pointing out two things, right? Why are we here? We're offering a logical reason that at least is part of the reason. And then the secondary thing is, what are we going to do to change it? Or are they going to just keep him in charge and he's going to just keep banging the wall?
Right.
What did you make of this? And again, this is where the FBI came back. So again, there's been four searches, and this is cool to understand. The first search is by Pima County on Sunday. Into the night, I've seen various reporting on that. Until it's all over, we're not going to know until we see the entrance and the exit times. But I mean, Nano says 20 hours. I've seen other people say they spent very little time in there. I don't know what the truth is.
Right.
But then we know that when the FBI gets involved, which again, the first ransom note that goes to the locals is on the second, but nobody knows about them. The third day is when TMZ gets it. He gets it 12 hours later, but it's actually on the 3rd of February. And then now he's got the FBI coming in. He said the FBI always knew about, and I believe that, and they volunteered to help. But they didn't come in full force until about the 4th or so. And then they do this search. They don't do this search. They do another search. And they forget the cameras. They forget to look up on the roof. Did that shock you?
I wish it would. You worked on the crime side. So you're used to dealing with the ERT guys, evidence response team guys, and everything a lot more than I did. All I know is I was one of those guys that wasn't on those teams. And all I know is whenever we had a big all hands on deck, anytime someone says all hands on deck, that meant stand by for putting on a show, because you're bringing in people with zero experience doing these things just to show boots on the ground. And that's why we see things like, remember a couple months ago, it was the Brown University guy that did the shooting. And you see FBI agents kicking snow in their mittens looking for evidence. That was me, because I was an evidence response guy. You know, because when you actually bring in our ERT team that's trained, it is highly efficient. It is very organized, very well trained, very good. But when you bring it in and all hands on deck, that means you're getting riffraff like me that typically don't work these cases, that are told we need a show of force. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And that's why you get chaos. And also, if you don't have, now we'll go down back to the leadership aspect of this. If you don't have a great on-scene commander or Nanos or whoever's in charge organizing this as a single point of focus, of single point of success or failure, managing all the wickets, you're dealing with chaos. And so what do I make of it? I hope it was more organized than it looked to the outside world, but it looked like a little bit of chaos to me. How about you?
Yeah, you know, I will say this. You can't know what you don't know.
That's why I said it always. Yep, you never know.
I learned this lesson was, and again, this is after the FBI is now involved, right? They've already done their initial search that they spent hours doing, and then they came back and did this search and did a forced search of the septic. So they didn't do their homework on the septic. And this search on the roof, I will tell you this, it was probably about year 10, maybe, as an FBI agent doing a gazillion search warrants. The only time I was interviewing somebody while we were doing a search warrant, I'm talking to him. Finally, after about 2-3 hours, he finally confesses, you know, I was waterboarding him for that amount of time. No, I'm just kidding. Don't take me seriously, please. Anyway, he confesses and he tells me where all the indicia of the crime is in his rain gutters. I can tell you the 10 years before I did a case, that case, I never looked in the rain gutters.
Reps.
Exactly.
If you don't have someone in there leading that team with reps, and you say it's all hands on deck, and you're going to, I mean, just think about it. I was so much part of this sometimes when you could call in. It's like, so here's a potential scenario where it can turn out two different ways with different reps. So say it's a big case. They know it's a big case. The Bureau knows it's a big case. And they say, all right, we're going to take our most senior person. And because you got 20 years in the Bureau, Jen, we're going to send you out and you're going to be in charge of the ERT, the evidence response on this scene. But to your point, you could have 20 years in the Bureau, but if you've never done a crime scene like this and had that experience with roof with gutters, you're not going to think of doing it because you don't have a rep that says my experience from past challenges that I faced and I overcame, you're not going to think of doing that. Meanwhile, you could have someone with 2 years in a bureau that just came off a case and did exactly the same thing. So when assessing who you're going to put on a case, you got to look at the experience they had, not just years, because it looks good when you're doing media. You have to look at what have you done in the past that's going to be relevant to what you're going to be doing now before you put them on the case. Because all those nooks and crannies that you think of intuitively now, because it took you 10 years to see, oh my gosh, we got to look at gutters. I mean, I learned this on one of our cases that we covered about a year ago, I think, about because someone was asking why they removing the drain catches in the house. Well, mm-hmm. because if they tried flushing blood, you know, blood splatter and wash their hands in a drain, it's going to be in the drain catch. How many people think of that unless you've actually experienced it, done it, or saw it on a true crime show? So same thing here. You don't know what you don't know, as you say.
Yeah. And I think that that's what happened here. I think that's why they missed it, because nobody else had thought about it. And then I think what happened was, you know, there was that motion. Remember, there was something to do with motion. And I think that when they got the information back, and I think they thought, oh, we missed a camera. The camera got that motion, and they went back and did it. A few questions here. I want to talk about the family. Mm. I know you have seen, like I have seen, it's rampant. I'm doing a whole series. I just finished, I did Annie, a whole rundown, everything about Annie, a whole rundown, everything about Tommaso, and I just finished Savannah's. In other words, what are people saying online about them and why they think they did this? And then what is the proof? And then what abuts the proof? What pushes back against what they see as proof? I tell you, just, you don't have to look far, but man, it's tough to read what they're saying about Savannah and Annie and Tommaso. And then I still have Cameron to do, and then I have the spouses to do. But my question to you is, tell me what in your research and with your background, why is it you don't believe Annie, Tommaso, the family is involved, if that's what you believe? I don't know that for sure. I didn't ask him before we came on.
It'd be a major spike out of their behavior pattern, 100%. So typically, the first thing you do is look at family when something like this happens, because it's the stats say if you're going to have a horrendous thing done to a family member, it's typically law of probabilities. It starts with another family member. That's why you always look at them first more deeply. But the first time you do that, you start looking at patterns of behavior. You look at the relationships. And the first thing I'm always doing is, do we have healthy relationships or unhealthy relationships? Do we have issues that are unresolved or issues that are resolved? It's because, you know, we had a very simple expression in the world of espionage, crime at the highest level on our side. And that was, happy people don't commit espionage. Happy people don't do crazy crap to others. Not all unhappy people do, but if something bad's going to happen, it's going to come from an unhealthy, unhappy relationship all the time. Because if you have a healthy relationship, you don't do bad things to other people. So what do you do first? You look at the type of relationships and the type of people that are involved close in on Nancy's side. So when you do a deep dive on Annie, you do a deep dive on Tommaso, you look at their background, you look at what they do, you look at prior records, if any, you look at relationships they have, and you look at patterns of behavior. And when you look at the first pattern of behavior, besides being a, and again, you've done much deeper dive on this, you know, he's a charter school teacher, no issues with anyone, he plays in a band, he's been married for a while, good relationships. He has his mother-in-law over routinely for Saturday night dinner, and plays games. If there was an issue, that would not be going on. I guarantee it. It just doesn't happen. And if it was about money, you just wait a couple years and you get it. I mean, that just made no logical sense. If it was you or a family member, there's other ways to get in that house that are a lot easier than what we saw. I mean, just all the patterns of behavior that would lead to family or either one of those are completely blown out of the water in the first 5 seconds of taking any kind of dive on them whatsoever. Doesn't mean it's 100%, but we're at 99.99% that it had nothing to do with them whatsoever. Why do you keep Annie's car for so long? Well, because, well, let's look at this reverse optic. Who's doing all the caretaking? Who's doing all the driving? Who's doing all the ins and outs of that house? Who's setting things up most likely for Nancy? It's going to be Annie. So why would you hold that car longer? If there's going to be DNA anywhere of someone that not affiliated with that family, it might be in that car. In other words, not that it's her, but if she's driving workers around, if she's bringing people in and out of that house, if there's family members, I mean, whatever it is, of course you're going to take a deeper look at the surroundings of Annie and her husband, because they're caretaking mom, not because they suspect them, but because if there's going to be extra data, extra leakage, where are you going to get it outside of Nancy's? I mean, think about this. If you're looking for more information and data and evidence, and you've searched on Nancy's house, where else might you look next? The only people in her life. So that's my explanation as to why I ruled them out exceptionally early on this one, because granted, in the world, I always go down the world of maybe, but if you're looking at laws, statistics, and so here you are as law enforcement, you have how many leads did they finally get in at the very end? And I know they still got like 40,000, 50,000, probably somewhere. We're talking tens of thousands of leads. And if you're looking at, and you're law enforcement, you have limited resources and bandwidth of what you can pay attention to, this is an easy one to stop paying attention to, because you need to look other places, because this does not line up whatsoever with any law of logic when it comes to who you're looking at. Granted, definitely look first, because that is a law of probability. It is most of the time, in a lot of these cases, unfortunately, it is family members, but it's easy to keep your focus on them at the early stages. In other words, so here's something to play out. If there had been family fights, family strife, struggles with money, life insurance policies that are in someone else's name, I mean, these are typical things that pop up. None of that's in play. So that's why.
No, it's, you answered that so concisely, succinctly, and fully. Thank you so much. I mean, we are on the same page with this. There is absolutely nothing behaviorally. You know, I've talked about, hey, I mean, if you really wanted to off your 84-year-old mother-in-law or mother,
there's a million other ways to do it, man.
Exactly. Take one of her 10 pills she has to take for pain and for blood pressure and for blood thinners and everything else, and just put one little salt size of fentanyl in one. She likely will have a heart attack. She's now deceased. Everybody says, oh, she had a heart attack. That's a shocker. She would have never been tested for those types of drugs. You have to specialty ask. And you think the family would ask for that?
You could kill her by neglect.
Exactly. You could smother her. Boy, we're getting mean now. But you
just ignore her. I mean, seriously, you know, I mean, that's why none of this made any sense. Because if there was any animosity there, you would see different behavior. Any. Because people, especially, so when you deal with someone in something for a long period of time, over a period of time, your true emotions towards that person leak out. There would be leakage. There would be family members saying, oh, I don't know, man. They're just an issue. See, you'd be seeing someone wringing their hands saying, I don't know. But none of that from family. None of that from friends. There's no other leakage from anyone in the circle of people outside of social media saying it was them. No one.
No.
That doesn't happen.
And it's so awful.
It is horrible.
Terrible. And one of the things that I really deep dive on, and for those in the audience asking, please, please go back and look. I think actually I'm featuring Tommaso right now. I might not be, but I should be if I'm not. But look on Tommaso. Look at the one I did on Annie. Look at the one I did on. I go through all the reasons why people say that they think they did this. And one of those reasons is their poetry / their music, that it's dark. People do not understand Annie's poetry if they think it's dark. Her poetry is so deep that you look at the words and you think it's dark because she has something that mentions like her main poem, and she's published. I mean, she is very talented. In my opinion, she's so talented, but she talks about the darkness is in the darkness. But that what she's talking about is how, for instance, like one's breath that we take is in the darkness. You know what I mean? To live that. And she gets so deep on so many different levels. She's one of the most intelligent, interesting poets that I've ever read. And I really look at, don't just take the headline. You know,
and do you really think that the elderly lady that goes to church every Sunday, whether it's via Zoom or in person, doesn't matter, with friends that she's been around for a long time, wouldn't have heard some leakage of what she felt about her daughter and son-in-law if it was anything but positive?
Exactly.
It's not always what isn't there. It's not what is there. It's a lot of times it's what's not there. And what's not there is any sign of any animosity being leaked out with relationships between Annie, her husband, and Nancy at any point from anyone. Zero. When you have zero leakage like that, what's the probability of there being nothing there? Pretty high.
Yeah. No, I agree. Nevertheless, it's never going to end. Robin, I have stolen now an hour and a half of your time. And you have been so gracious with it. And I just want to thank you. Let me get you.
Oh, thank you for having, I love deep, fun conversations that, you know, just, you know, pressing each other, going down these different avenues, because, you know, it's what we should do in all these cases is think deeply, think hard, press all these different areas, press these different theories, flush them out. Having listened to you, I expanded into areas I hadn't considered before. I mean, just on this one, you know, the idea of, you know, using the branch to get that Nest camera off. Wow, I hadn't thought about that. I'm all in. That sounds logical, because that's what we do in these cases. Does it make logical sense from tactical, you know, material evidence? And does it make sense behaviorally as well? When we can bind these things together, that's when we can start solving these cases. As well as making sure we have great leadership at the top that can put the right people at the right place to flesh these things out for us too. So thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You're the best. I'll see you soon, Friday.
You betcha.
All right. Thanks again. You guys, that was Robin Drake. Love that guy. He's so smart. Look at, he went to the Naval Academy, so difficult to get into. That's why I wanted him to share a little bit of his background, because I will say in all my years of work, 28 years professionally as an agent, and then even now in the realm of expert witness working for all these different lawyers and United States attorney's offices, I tell you, I just always pinched myself when it came to my fellow FBI agents. Just their backgrounds were always so very, very impressive. The amount of time typically it took them even to get in. I call it, if you can imagine, a big barrel of apples. And so you have all these people that have thrown their thousands and thousands every year, tens of thousands. And you have them applying to the Bureau. And some years, the apples that come to the top, they're just too red and shiny. And so the other apples can't compete. But then other years, as those apples get off, you know, and it's all cyclical too. Some years, the FBI doesn't hire for years. So now imagine all those names, all those backgrounds, all those resumes, all those amazing people to choose from that are in the barrel. And even though they're amazing, they're at the bottom because there's other people that are a little bit more amazing. So it's really, really humbling. It was always humbling. Every time I looked around right and left and saw who was on my squad. And Robin brings such a sense of intelligence, in my opinion, and professionalism. Yes, he called him an idiot, but I think a lot of people believe that a lot of the things that he has done is idiocy. Nevertheless, I don't want to digress. I just want to say I loved having him on the show and cutting up this case in a way we really haven't done before, a very broad, general way and touching on everything we know about this case. For those who became members today, I just want to thank you so much. I really appreciate it. NJZ offering up another membership. I mean, just so generous of you. And for each of you that spent your 4 to 5:30 evening with us, I know our show is normally in the morning. And this, I think, is a tougher time for people to come on board. But tomorrow we'll be back to a morning show. And I'm working on a cardiologist right now that I think will be really knowledgeable in the area and also articulate that you can understand, like we did with the Bitcoin, to really understand the ins and outs of right now of that particular pacemaker, of a newer, you know, high-speed, low-drag pacemaker. And I think a lot of people have a lot of questions about it. And so we're going to get down and dirty on the pacemaker. We also have Cameron. Cameron is also next up, coming soon to discuss him because he's the silent one. He's one that nobody really knows about. And I've seen a lot about Cameron also out there. So what I like to do is I pull different things that I read and then we'll bring it in and discuss it. But everybody, thank you for being here. Y'all are great. Thank you to the mods who are the absolute best in the business. So lucky to have these mods. And till next time, I want to thank everybody. May justice be served for the Guthrie family. And I always put a picture of her up. I'm sorry. For the Guthrie family and for all the missing.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.